Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, anyone in between, and all those still trying to figure it the fuck out, please sit back, relax, put in your earphones, and buckle your seatbelts. The next 2 hours are guaranteed to not be safe for work. Now welcome to your speakers, smartphones, or laptop, America's sweetheart, Pollo Del Mar, and a San Francisco's blazing beauty, Pearl Tees. It's time for Podomatic's number one ranked LGBT podcast, and 120 minutes of your life you will never get back. Brought to you in conjunction with San Francisco's Left Magazine, it's time for Party Foul Radio with Pollo and Pearl.
Hello again, everybody. Welcome to episode 92 of Party Foul Radio. I'm Miss Pollo Del Mar.
And I'm Pearl Teeth.
We are sitting here in a darkened studio.
Yeah, girl. Pollo's lights went out, girl.
The lights are out on apparently the entire street. We walked up. We're hoping that we can get some of this done. There's only 19%
left on this computer.
On this computer, and no kind of energy or electricity to try to boot this up. Bitch, we should have like exercycles that we could hook up to.
Right.
Create like a windmill in the backyard or something. Anyway, we'll see what we get through without the computer completely going dead on us. But in advance of later on in the show, we have singer Trey Pearson on with us. He is going to be talking about his new album, which drops this Friday. I've had a chance to listen to it. I told you guys about it before. It's called The Good Grief. Go check it out. It's a really good interview. Very, very good interview. That is coming up for you this week. Also, thousands of you guys out there are still listening to our Kelly Clarkson interview. We've gotten another almost 20,000 listens on
Girl,
that.
Come on, $100,000 club.
Well, I don't know. It's not a $100,000 club. It's just a $100,000 club. But we're both really stoked about the idea that Kelly Clarkson could possibly be our first episode that breaks 100,000 listens.
I would live.
Yeah, me too, girl. Because you know we'll be using those numbers to pimp our podcast out to every A-list celebrity. Be like, right. Well, Kelly Clarkson was on and she got over 100,000 listens.
Right.
So it's pretty exciting for us. And I think it's up to around 70,000 some listens.
Bitch, we're so close.
And the good thing about this is that even if we don't get it right away, eventually people keep still coming and finding these things. Like people are still listening.
And it can still be part of the 100,000.
Yeah. It's like, it's just about 100,000 cumulative. So, okay. I mean, you know, it's not about our first week of release or whatever. So
that's sickening.
We're going to get that 100,000 club, girl.
Uh-huh.
We're going to do it. So what else? Oh, I did want to say, I want to start off this week's podcast by saying how excited I am. Pearl actually and I ran into each other in the street when she was coming to my house. I wasn't quite home yet. And I was just responding to an email. This week on Friday, the 17th, I kick off my third annual Sock It to Homelessness Sock, Underwear, and Toiletries Drive.
Oh, nice.
And it is something that obviously I've been doing for a number of years now. And it's in conjunction with one of our sponsors, Daddy's Barbershop, helps present this every year. They're kind enough. When I asked about doing this the first year, they were one of the first locations I asked if they would host a drop-off box. And because they have a small back area every year, the poor guys, every year it gets bigger and bigger and they get more and more irritated because I will be like, okay, you guys, we have to store all this stuff here. If one of the boxes fills up, I take it down to Daddy's, and their back room is not very big. So last year, because it was the turnout for this event was really good, like their whole office was filled up. Their back storage area, which is also the bathroom for the shop, was filled up. But this year, I'm really excited because I was answering an email when I saw you. That's when you were like, hurry up, bitch. Like, I was answering an email from Fitness SF locations in San Francisco, and they're interested in possibly hosting drop boxes for us. And Fitness SF has something like 6 locations in the Bay Area. So if we are able to partner with Fitness SF and get stuff into those locations, it's going to do so much good for like our ability to reach new places and new people and get new donations.
That's beautiful. I love that.
I am really excited about it. Like I said, last year was the second year and we had 3 carloads of stuff, like, you know, and when I'm sure that there are people out there who are listening to this are like, three carloads of stuff isn't that much. And I agree with you, because that's why I want five carloads this year of stuff. But when you're talking about three carloads of things that will be getting distributed to the homeless population of San Francisco that they would not otherwise have, mm-hmm. that's a lot, girl. Right. If you ain't got nothing, something's a lot. And when you've got three carloads that we can distribute, that's even better.
That's amazing.
And we partner with an organization. Well, that's not true. We benefit an organization called San Francisco Night Ministries. And San Francisco Night Ministries has been doing work, kind of like God's work, in the community for generations now. And while they are a religious affiliated organization, the reason I like them and the reason I chose them is because they are an all-embracing, affirming, non-judgmental, non-denominational organization where it's people from various different religious backgrounds and whatever come together, and then they walk the streets, literally, of San Francisco from 10 p.m. until 4 a.m. every single night of the year, 365 days a year, and they provide a concerned, caring, listening ear for people who are in need. They provide resources and referral information for people in need. And they also, if they have them available, provide amenities such as personal care products. In particular, they'll provide socks, underwear, like anything that they have. And of course, they have a limited ability to accumulate that on their own. So that's why something like our Sock It to Homelessness drive is so important, because we do the fundraising for them, and then we basically just give them goods to better do the job they're already mm-hmm. doing. So while our primary goal is to raise underwear and socks, because if you're homeless, you guys, and it's raining and it's cold and your feet are soaking wet and you ain't got no kind of dry socks, it's considered the number one thing that can cause health risks and illness and even death among homeless people, is that they're unable to get dry and they're unable to stay warm. So providing undergarments such as socks and underwear is so significant. And in fact, one of my friends who is obviously not home, well, not obviously necessarily, but who is not homeless now, a number of years ago was living on the streets of San Francisco, like, you know, one of those people just pushing a shopping cart. And he has turned his life around in big, big ways now. But he said that at that time, he said that socks were like gold. That's his quote. Socks were, quote, like gold to people in his position, because he, you know, his feet would be soaking wet. And I remember, girl, when I was, there was a period of time between when I was like reaching my bottom in terms of my drug use and when I went into rehab, I was sort of like, there was a few weeks where I was sort of on the street, on and off the streets. Mm-hmm. And it was like winter. It was February, April of 2004, and it was wet and it was cold. And I remember I had a hole in my shoes and I was miserable because everywhere I went, my fucking feet were soaking wet.
Yeah.
And it was freezing. So it's just one of those things where we can give back just a little bit to make the lives of other people better in a way, you know, like,
in a big way for them.
Yeah, in a big way for them. And we're not in a position where we can really change their life circumstances. There are resources available, and people like Father Lyle Beckman and others who are affiliated with San Francisco Night Ministry can provide them information and referrals and resources to say, like, go here. This is how you can do it. They can explain the whole process. And if people are so inclined to take him up on that, they can move themselves in a direction to ideally get off of the streets and get into a better situation. But just doing that when you're exhausted and cold and wet and nasty feeling, like, is God, you know?
Rough.
It is rough. Now, I know that you work a lot with mental health services and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Do you work with people who live on the streets?
Yeah, some of my clients are homeless.
Oh my gosh.
A lot of my clients are homeless. Not all of them. It doesn't even feel so, you know, I see it. I see it every day.
Yeah, it's a situation that's, so how this Sock It to Homelessness started, you guys, is 3 years ago, I took this photo in Jane Warner Plaza, which is a main plaza area in the Castro District. And it used to be where the F line turned around, and it used to be a street, but now It's been blocked off, and it's just a nice little plaza where the F line of San Francisco, which is one of the main streetcar lines, ends. Since they've done the renovations to the plaza, part of the intention is for there to be various kinds of social activities or entertainment activities. But at this particular time that I took the photo, there was about probably 20 homeless people sort of encamped there, like in this one corner. Mm-hmm. And there were a whole bunch of locals who live in the area, like over onto the other side of it. And there was, and I took this photo of the two groups of people and I posted it on my Facebook and I said, what can we do? What are we going to do about this? And when underneath it, a whole bunch of people thought that I meant like, how are we going to get rid of these homeless people like out of our neighborhood? And they kind of went off on that tangent. And then a whole bunch of other people were like frustrated at the people's perceptions and feelings and attitudes directed towards the homeless people and argued on behalf of the homeless people. And then I got caught in the middle because people were like attacking me. And well, the reality of what I was actually trying to ask from that photo is like, there's this huge separation here. And what do we do to where the people on one side who obviously may not have a lot necessarily, because the perception that if you live in San Francisco means that you have a lot. Well, honey, it could actually mean that you are like one paycheck away from being on the other side of the spectrum anyway.
Right, exactly.
And that is the fucking truth. Mm-hmm. So especially for people in the entertainment industry, a lot of us are like, myself very much included, one paycheck or one whatever away from real financial insecurity. So the idea was, what can one side of this picture do to help the other side of the picture? And as a result of that, that particular photo and kind of online commentary got shared dozens and dozens of times through social media and ultimately ended up with about 75,000 people seeing it. And I was so glad for that, because then at the end of it, I said, by the way, this is what we can do. And I launched this sock drive and said, if you've been commenting on this, regardless of which side you're on, if you're on the side that wants these people out of your neighborhood, well, then here's a way for you to help give them something so maybe they can get better, like better their life situation, and they'll be able to move into a different situation. If you're on the other side that thinks that like it's horrible that people are mistreating them, here's your chance to fucking put your money where your mouth is and like do something to help out.
Right.
So, and it's only grown since that first year. Now, this year we will be having new donation locations. Already I've confirmed Ferment Drink Repeat, FDR Brewery, which is in the Portola neighborhood. So the Portola district is jumping in on this. So hopefully they'll help raise some goods for the homeless. If, in fact, Fitness SF comes on board, that would be humongous for us because of the fact that they have locations everywhere and presumably can tap into people who have not previously donated. Daddy's Barbershop in the Castro, remember, 4102 19th Street at Castro. They are a primary donation location, as is the Castro Country Club, 4058 18th Street in the Castro. The Castro Country Club is our biggest donation location. Those sober queens really fucking get into helping out, and it's miraculous. So big, big thanks to all my friends in the sober community. And one of the area, another donation location is Phil's Coffee, which I think is located at 349 Castro Street, or it's right there on Castro between 18th and 19th.
You guys can obviously send Poyo a message if you need a location.
Yes.
So just send her a message and she can tell you where to go.
Yes. And look for all this information will be coming to my Facebook page.
Boom.
So yeah, just get into it. If you're local, please donate. And the great thing about this is it's an idea and a model that's so easy to do that you can replicate it wherever you live. So other people have done that already and there's a similar model to this that was inspired by us here in San Francisco that popped up in Indiana to help people who are there. So take this idea with you wherever you may be. You guys, we're at 3% on this computer.
So we'll be right back after this just so we can save this just in case.
Yeah, exactly. We'll be back in a moment. Party Foul Radio is brought to you in conjunction with Daddy's Barbershop, located at 4102 19th Street at Castro, in San Francisco's Castro District. Daddy's Barbershop was voted San Francisco's favorite barbershop in the 2017 Bestie Awards. Visit Arlen, Jesse, and the men and women of Daddy's Barbershop and tell them Party Foul Radio sent you.
All right, so we are back and we are about to die, so we're going to try to do this.
We're doing as much as we can, girl.
So actually, I don't know if you remember this, but a year from when you guys are listening...
Was your transition? Were your boobs?
That? It's when I went and had breast augmentation. So my boobs turn a year tomorrow, today, for when you guys are hearing this.
Oh my God. I thought that they looked like they were celebrating. Look at that. Such a W. Oh, Pearl's tits are over here just like having a party.
Finally a year old? Yes, I know. I'm so happy. A year. I just love them so much. She just keeps looking down at her own boobs. And the thing is, like, they really, I feel like it's, having them has made me so much just more confident in who I am as a person, because I'm a little bit more comfortable with my body. Not to say that, like, there's not still things that need to happen.
Well, that's, but I mean, that's just human existence. There's, no matter what body you have, there's always something you want different about it, so... Right. Whatever, but... I mean, but...
every time, like, I'm having just, like, a really down moment, I'm always like, girl, at least you got these.
Oh, my God.
So happy.
Everything goes wrong in the world. She just clutches her breast. Right. We got each other, baby.
There's a bomb going off outside, but, girl, I still got my titties.
Oh, my God. Well, that's good. That is really, really good.
It's been a year. Can you imagine? Do you... I mean, you
were I remember, girl. I remember the whole process.
You were there the day... I think you were... The first day I left my house with my boobs.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
It was Thanksgiving dinner. So I think you saw me at Jose's house. Yeah.
Yep, I did. Aww.
It's already a year, girl.
Our little girls are growing up.
Right.
I'm not talking about Pearl. I'm talking about the boobs, you guys.
Kelly and Michelle.
Our little girls are... Kelly and Michelle. It's so strange that she should pick Kelly and Michelle knowing that she is Latavia.
Oh, snap.
Whatever, bitch. Oh! Whatever, bitch.
And we are back. You guys, we have now relocated to Pearl's abode.
Yeah, because Poyo's mess, girl, just...
Well, first of all, it's not my fault. Second of all, I think that we're going to hear probably echoes here because her home is very small. This kitchen that we were in, it's smaller and, like, more closed off than my place. You'll also hear...
So maybe you'll hear us louder.
Oh, God. You also hear rickety chairs and stuff. That's
better than a chair breaking down on you while you're sitting in it.
Well.
Two or three of them, actually.
Not my fault that that happens to Pearl every time she sits in a chair.
Whatever.
So, anyway, we are at Pearl's house. We had to come across town because the electricity is out in my entire neighborhood.
And Poyo's computer died.
Everything died. So, we are now here. And this is our first time changing locations mid-podcast.
Right.
We should probably, hold on, we're going to save this. I want to hear if we're echoey.
Is the microphone breaking? Or...
No, we're all good. Okay, well, so maybe this will be better. We're like I said, we are at Pearl's. Oh, there's like buses and trains coming past, girl.
Yeah, you guys will feel like you're listening to a real city podcast, girl.
Yes, honey. Right here, there's a bus line that just stopped right in front of our place. So, as we were saying, right before the computer died, literally as the computer died, Pearl's breast just celebrated 1 year.
No, we celebrate a year in, like...
Hours.
Yeah, an hour.
By the time you're hearing this, her boobs will be one.
One.
So, oh my gosh, Pearl will never age. Like, little, incrementally, different pieces of her will be different ages.
Yep.
So she'll just always, like, start to claim the youngest thing. She'll be like, I'm only 21. They'll be like, that's just your boobs, bitch. So, anyway, what did you end up doing over the weekend, Pearl? We didn't even do our weekend recap for this.
I know. So me and you both had Carney's gig with Audrey because Carney is out of town in New York.
Carney returns from New York when you guys are listening to this. She gets back on Wednesday, so she'll be back tomorrow.
So I had that, and then I had Asia. So Saturday I was in heels for 12 fucking hours, girl.
Yeah, I was in drag from, not for 12 hours, for sure, but I was in drag from around noontime until 10 o'clock, and then when I came home and I took everything off, it was the first time that I really remember sitting and feeling my legs, from the knees down, my legs were throbbing, like my calves and my feet were just throbbing, like,
girl, that's just more signs of Poyo getting old, y'all.
That's signs of me being a hard worker and being out on the gigs all day. Because I didn't just do our gig over at brunch at Lookout, which, by the way, that crowd was amazing. That was the best crowd that I've ever performed for at Lookout. The most accepting, the most, like, the most tippinest. Like, they really...
Yeah, girl, I got paid.
We really got paid, girl.
Yeah.
So, that's why I was like... And plus, the crowd was, like, really large. If it had been me, and they kept wanting more, so I'd have been like, bitch, if you gotta do another one,
right,
make some more coins, because it's not often... Too often... The girls are out there, like, working their asses off and getting, like, come back and, like, I made $7.
Oh.
That's the worst feeling. Like, well, girl, that's the worst feeling. Like, I was in Sacramento on Sunday night, and, like, I think I made $30 in two performances. And it had nothing to do with me. It has to do with the fact that sometimes audiences... No, I saw the girl...
Listen, a play I've never just taken responsibility
it's for not, her, because so. I saw the other bitches come back, too, and, like... You know,
who were the other bitches?
All the local girls, like the local girls from there. Like,
they have a lot of girls out there.
So, I mean, it comes down to some audiences are there for you, and there some audiences are not there for you. Like, sometimes you'll be at a show, and this used to happen even when I had my show at the cafe. Every now and then, it wasn't very often for sure, but sometimes you'll just do a show, and it feels like you're almost interrupting the people's whatever they've got going on. And I hate when people have shows like that. And that's how, back in the day, I used to do these circuit parties for Gus Bean. Gus Presents here in San Francisco.
That's how I feel like, because he used to do the show at the Crib also.
Yeah.
And even that show kind of felt like you were just interrupting the party.
Right. Well, I mean, when I was hosting at the Crib, sometimes it felt a little less like that. But there were, when ultimately, you know, I like Gus very much, and all of his circuit parties, he used to hire me to come in and, like, be the host or whatever. But ultimately, most of the time, I wasn't even performing. I was just, like, the MC or whatever. Mm-hmm. And even then...
They were like, girl, get off the mic.
It just felt pointless, and I hate that. I like being at a party where people expect you to be at the party, and where they're at the party for you. Not, like, as the whole party, but, like, where it's expected and appreciated. And there's no point in doing all that we do if ain't nobody paying no attention or, like, not appreciating it or whatever.
Right.
So, it was just, I don't like that. So, back to the original story, that party that we were at on Saturday afternoon at Lookout was popping, and they were living for our drag, and that's why I was like, oh, dude, let me do it again. I got another song on there. I got another one and another outfit.
And I was like, well, I got to go.
Girl, you could have gone, bitch. I'd have just gone out there. I mean, I walked off stage at one point from 1 5-minute performance with $50 in my hand. So,
I came home with, you guys have three numbers, and, like, I came home with almost $200 from that show.
Yep, me too. It was very, very well paid, and that's why I was like, girl, when you get an audience like that, and there was nothing else, like, we weren't interrupting something else there.
Right.
Girl, just keep the show going. If that's what they want to do, like, put some more business out there, let them get paid, because you know that the next time you're there, you'll be like, woohoo, I made $14.
I don't know. That show's been, every time I've been there lately, it's been pretty good.
It goes up and down. There have been times when I've been there and it's been, like, not that many people or whatever. Mm-hmm. The size of a crowd is never indicative necessarily of the amount of tips you're going to make either, because I've been at places where you look at the crowd and think, okay, I'm going to make $10 out here because there's barely anybody here. Then you walk out with fistfuls of dollars or whatever.
Because the crowd
is there for you.
Right.
They're there for you. They're there for the show. And then I've been at other times where you're like, the place is packed and you walk off with like $5. Because, like, they're more interested in talking with their girlfriend next door or, like, next to them or whatever. So I went from that event down to the Edge, where Grand Duke, Mad Dog 2020, and Miss Shogun were putting on an event for the Grand Ducal Council of San Francisco. I got there super early. The event really technically started at 5, but I got there a little after 4, so it was still people filing in or whatever. Oh, so as I'm walking in, this is like one of those situations where I'm so glad that I'm a different person than I was like 5 years ago, because this would have led to some poor fucking whore getting a total beat down. I walk in, and there's some drunk bitch standing outside. Y'all, so now you're getting to hear, like, Pearl complains about my place, but... Now there's an alarm going off. We've heard 18 motorcycles, 16 buses.
Whatever, bitch, please.
So I'm walking into the Edge, and this drunk bitch is like, hey, fat ass!
This is talking to you.
Yeah. And I turn around.
Of course you did.
And she's like, twerk! Twerk, bitch!
What? She calls you a fat ass and then just tells you the twerk.
Uh-huh.
Well, and one, she really did not want to see that. She had no...
And then, but the funny thing was, like, I just stopped, and in my head I was like, should I kill her? Like, not physically. Should I, like, should I make her cry right now? Because I could, and I can. And if you guys have listened to this podcast for long enough, you know that if I want to go for somebody, bitch, I'm going to come. For you, and especially since you obviously sent for me, so in this situation,
and then, come on, fat ass.
And then I looked at her, and I just turned and walked in the door and didn't even say a word. And Beyonce Growls was out there too, and she was like, and later on, she said to me when I came back out, she goes, "Just so you know, you didn't have to say anything to her because your look said it all." And the girl went, "We should probably go before I get in trouble." Unfortunately, they did not go. They like sort of milled around and were creating. They were one of those groups of presumably heterosexual women. I don't know that for a fact, but you know, they read to me like straight women to me, and they were that kind of group of girls that go out and they get drunk and like, or one of them gets really drunk and then it's a mess and causes a problem everywhere they go because they were complaining, people at Badlands are so mean to us. Really? Probably because your friend is a fucking total twat. Like, right. Probably she's a dumb bitch. And so they got thrown out of there. Then they came to the Edge, which is right down the street. And like, I don't know if they got thrown out of there or not, but I left. Anyway, I went to the Edge and then I went, okay, so this is like, this was a shock for me. You'll understand why. I've been doing drag for a pretty fucking long time, and I get this text message.
You went to 440.
No, well, I've been to 440 many times, but I got a text message, and it's like, "Hey, I'm down at Midnight Sun doing a fundraiser, and I would love to have an opportunity to talk to you. Why don't you pop in?"
What the?
I don't know, because the number is whatever. So I text back, "Hey, I don't have this number saved on my phone. Who is this?" Response: "It's Donna Sachet."
Bitch, oh my God.
I'm gagged because you guys, Donna Sachet is like iconic in the San Francisco community.
Lady in Red.
Yeah, she every year at Pride they put Donna Sachet on the cover of the San Francisco Chronicle. She's like,
well, she's usually the person who also and does she's, the emceeing on television yes, for the Pride Parade.
She's the television MC for the San Francisco Pride Parade, and I've known Donna for years, but I've never. Like, I've gone to her house a couple times for different parties or whatever, but it's not like I don't feel like we're in the same social circle. I was shocked to get a text from her. So
what did she want?
She just wanted to talk because she had heard, you guys know that she's Empress 30 of San Francisco. And
oh, she wanted to talk about your aspiration.
She wanted to talk to me about my aspiration for,
oh,
you
so
know.
You're really going to do this, girl.
I really am going to do this, girl. So I went down and I talked to her. It was really nice because I think, well, this is what was surprising to me, is that I told a number of people that 5 years ago, if I had expressed these same aspirations, the Imperial Council would not have been half as supportive as they have been. Because I think I had a different reputation. They saw me in a different way.
5 years ago?
5 years ago.
You had the same reputation.
No, I, yeah. Well, I don't.
She was still a bitch, y'all.
Well, I think that what I mean by that is that 5 years ago, like,
you probably just had some extra weight on you.
What it came down to is that 5 years ago, I was really in a different, I was just a different person in terms of my perspective. And what I tried to explain to Donna is, like, 5 years ago, one of the big differences, for example, is that I looked at the Imperial Council and the Grand Ducal Council, which is structurally are almost identical. Like, structure, in terms of the organization, almost exactly the same in structure. But culturally speaking, they're entirely different. Like, what the intention of both organizations is similar, but the way they approach things is really different. And I used to be of the mindset that they should be the same. Like, in terms of what I wanted from the community and for the community at the time, the Ducal Council by far outweighed the Imperial Council. But the way I view it now is these are totally separate organizations, and culturally speaking, different organizations should have different cultures. Like, they should have different approaches to things. If they want to accomplish different things, then you can't do the same thing. So that's why I explained to her, I was like, well, I want to embrace what the Imperial Council is about right now. And, like, it's a different time in my drag career. It's a different time in my life. And this is a great time for me to embrace that and kind of pursue those goals, which the goals that I'm talking about specifically are the Imperial Council places a great deal of emphasis on how they represent San Francisco outside of San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
Their work within the community here in San Francisco, so they're very prominent and they're very present in a lot of activities and they do a lot of things, but the Imperial Council specifically has a great deal of presence outside of San Francisco.
Yeah, because there's a bunch of them all over the place.
Right. San Francisco Imperial Council is the mother organization of the entire International Imperial Council, the ICC. And so they spend a lot of time traveling and representing San Francisco in different places and whatever. Mm-hmm. That is one of the things that really intrigues me right now. I would love the opportunity to travel and get to meet these queens from all over. And
as the Empress, though, you know, you're the one that has to pay for all that.
As Empress, a big part of it is covered, but you have lots of opportunity to, I mean, they do a lot of fundraising to help you do all those things.
Okay.
So, and some people, girl, it is super, you're going to be hearing everything. Every train, every car, every bus, bitch. Even the refrigerator that's like humming.
It's better than three little rats running around the house, barking and eating out each other, girl.
Eating out each other.
Yeah, they do. I've seen your dogs do it. You've seen your dogs do it.
Not eating out each other.
They be doing it.
And you know, like...
Nasty.
Well, you know what's nasty about that?
Do, girl.
The grammatical incorrectness, because it should be eating each other out. So...
Whatever, bitch. You know what they do in your house?
So, anyway, but it's really cool, because the other thing is that if you know that... If people within the Imperial organization know that you are willing to do this travel and represent them in a way that they feel comfortable with, there's a lot of money involved there. So people are willing to kind of help you out. You know what I mean? Like, and I look forward to the opportunity, if given that chance, to explore the whole world of court systems and like get to travel a little bit. And it'll be a lot. I'll say this for you guys, the listeners of the podcast, there'll be a lot of reports from here and there and wherever. My God. Pearl's not featuring it.
I'm not featuring it at all, girl. I'm just, you know.
So, but I do think that it will be it'll be an interesting adventure for me, and it gets to sort of move into the second phase of it. Now that my aspirations are announced and out there, obviously they're very out there, because, I mean, Donna's asking me about it, and other people are asking me about it, too. So, ideally, the next phase becomes when I pick up an application in December. So, we'll see.
December. Is it early December?
I think they put out applications in mid-December, and then in mid-January you turn in those applications for a review board.
And then what is it, February?
And then it's after review board, which is in mid-January, you become an official candidate, and then, or contestant candidate, and then they do elections in like mid-February, and then coronation is at the end of February.
Oh, good luck, girl.
It's you guys, like, it's a different adventure. It's something that I want to check out and explore and see what it's like. So,
well, let me know how it goes.
Oh, my God. She's so shady. So shady.
So, after the lookout, I had Asia. I had Asia the next day on Sunday also.
You had it on Sunday, too?
Yeah. I worked all weekend.
What days are they traditionally open?
Asia. They are open Wednesday through Sunday.
Oh, okay. Because I don't know why. Like, I have been there. I met Kathleen Turner, the actress Kathleen Turner, at Asia SF1.
We had one of the MCs from KBLX there recently. And then we also had some big, huge actor from the Philippines there that I didn't know.
Well, I'm sure.
But apparently a lot of, like, people...
Right, it's a destination location in San Francisco, especially now that they've had a reality TV show based on it. It's like raised people's awareness to that even more. Mm-hmm. So, speaking of which, is there talk about, are they going to do a season 3 of Transcendent?
Not that I know of.
Okay, I didn't know.
Not that I know of.
I'm sure that in many ways that was a good experience for those girls, but I think that it probably, in terms of like a workplace and work environment, having all that drama playing out on TV for people, it just makes it not appealing to deal with.
I think
that it probably created drama between the girls that wouldn't have existed otherwise. I mean, I don't know that for a fact, but that's a guess.
There's a lot of things that television show did not depict. correctly about AJSF in the first place. Like, there's a few girls that do not work there.
Who were on the show?
Yes.
Yeah, there. I did know that they brought in people to participate on the show because they have. It's just like any television show, listeners. When reality TV casts it, the people who are going to be on it, whatever show that might be, they're not really casting individuals. They're casting characters.
Yeah.
So if they don't have a character in place,
they'll find one elsewhere.
Yes.
Whether that person really works or whatever point of it is going to be.
They will find that individual. And that's all reality TV. So when you are watching RuPaul's Drag Race and you're wondering why your favorite queens may never be cast on there or this or that, it's because they don't have a role for them.
Right.
My drag mother, Landa Lakes, was heavily considered for a couple of seasons of RuPaul's Drag Race. And one of the seasons that she was on the alternative, the alternate list to be cast on, when they came back to her after they had her sort of sitting on hold, their reason for not casting her was specifically, we do not have a role for you. Mm-hmm. Not because you shouldn't be on the show or whatever. Yeah. We don't know how to... we don't know which role to have you play. We don't know how to cast you. We don't know which character you would be.
Yeah.
Would you be the bitch? Would you be the wise mother? Would you be the artistic one?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's why when you watch episodes of Drag Race, for example, you can, after two episodes, people who are fervent and longtime viewers of the show immediately draw correlations between...
She would have been so much better than Alexis Michelle.
Well,
she would have.
Well, I'm not saying yes or no to that. That wasn't even the season. She didn't even audition for that season.
Oh, damn.
She, Landa has been considered, was strongly considered for seasons 1, 2, I want to say 3, and maybe 5.
I want to say Lady Tia was up for those seasons also, the very early season.
Lady Tia was also being considered for seasons 1 and 2, from what I understand as well.
Yeah.
And Lady Tia, to this day, would be amazing on that show.
Yeah, but she just doesn't want to do it. She doesn't want that lifestyle. I talked to her about it, and she told me she has worked too hard for the lifestyle she has now, and she doesn't want to jeopardize it by going on that show.
I don't know how... Well, I don't see how being on Drag Race would jeopardize her particular...
She probably have to quit her job.
Right. I do think that that'd be one way of it. I think when a lot of people look at the opportunity, and if they were to say, they don't want to jeopardize this or that, I think a big part of it would be if, for example, somebody... Like, Lady Tia is very respected in the local community. She's got great long-time gigs that she's done locally, but in terms of as a personality, she's not super out there in the public.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not a lot that the show could do to turn people's existing perception of her wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I think of people and I think this might have been one of Landa's concerns. Landa is very, very, very active in the broader community. Like, she's super involved in the Native American community on an international level. She's very involved in the court system locally. She's very involved in things that she utilizes drag to participate in, fundraising for all of these Native American organizations.
Yeah.
She attends and helps coordinate all of these powwows to support her Native American culture.
She's a producer of one of the biggest ones out there.
Yes, she's one of the producers of the biggest powwow, I think, on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm. It is.
And so with her, because there is a perception of who she is well beyond just her drag or associated with her drag, if she were to go on there and they were to do something really shady and portray her in a way that would be unflattering, it could really fuck up her reputation. And I think that that's something that people would be concerned about. And Landa's been doing this much longer than I have, but even with me, I'm like, okay.
But besides the actual art, you could never tell. Landa looks pretty young. And Poyo, y'all know what Poyo looks like.
Well, with my situation, I do feel like I have worked really hard to cultivate a nice following that, of course, being on something like a Drag Race would increase. But at the same time, you never know how they're going to portray you. So the fact of the matter is that when you guys as listeners hear me like say really horrible bitchy things or whatever, you're also invested in me previously and you know a little bit about me, so that you...
Yeah, but these people on TV are some judged
to
filth, girl. Yes. I would live.
And right, and I would not. Like it would, it's one of those things that I'm aware of, and that's why I tend to be like friends with like all the people who've ever been portrayed as a bitch on the show, because
girl, that's where you would fit. That's
birds of a feather do flock. Yeah, they do flock together. But at the same time, like people who, like, I mean, let's be clear here. You guys, like, probably the most hated person in Drag Race history is Phoebe O'Hara, who just raised $80,000 for Puerto Rico coordinating.
I don't know. That's arguable, because I know a lot of people don't like Tyra Sanchez also.
Well, yes, but I think that Tyra, I don't know. Tyra definitely...
And girl, Jasmine Masters got a lot of heat, too. But nowhere near, I think, as much as Tyra Sanchez.
Well, like, the reason that Fifi is, like, probably the most hated person in Drag Race history is because not even anything particularly that she did. Oh, my God, you guys. The trains are just really nonstop. The one thing you can say about Pearl's Place is that there's no, like, lack of public transportation. There's been, like, 75,000 buses and trains passed here literally in the last 20 minutes.
And Pollo thinks I live in the middle of nowhere. Girl, she does.
Pearl does live in the middle of nowhere. No. The reason there's 5,000 buses is because if anybody's like going to get to anywhere in the city, they have to fucking have some public transportation, because this place is on the edge of the earth.
Oh, no.
But what I was going to say is that they created Sharon Needles to be this humongous, like, hero on her season. And as a result of how heroic they made Sharon in terms of the viewers, that meant that Fifi, as her main opposition, is going to take the brunt of that. You know what I mean? So, yeah. But the point being that...
The gag about that situation just because is that Sharon is actually kind of more of a bitch than Fifi is.
So, and...
Even though kind of to it, Sharon is not a good person.
Well, Sharon has been mired in a lot of public controversy that one would have to think speaks to the kind of person that she is.
Right.
Like, from the racist things that she's gone through to just all kinds of other elements of it. I think it speaks more to who she is as a person on, like, a core level than anything one thinks about Fifi. Like, mostly they think that Fifi was shady to her in the context of a competition. Well, I'm sorry, bitch. Like,
that's how it goes.
It's a competition. Yeah. And Fifi wanted to win. So, and she felt at the time that her kind of drag was different and better than what was being presented.
Right.
So, but Fifi really did just coordinate that big drag queen show that raised $80,000 for Puerto Rico.
Yes.
And she's the one who spearheaded it. She's the one who put everything behind it. And, you know, come on now. Like, you need to give that bitch props.
Was it $80,000 or $10,000?
I saw the last time I saw, she tweeted that they were just a few thousand dollars short of $80,000. They had $76,000. And that was like a week ago.
And because she did say she was still collecting money.
Right. Reina's United and Queens United.
Queens United, yeah.
Reina's Unidos.
Yeah.
Like, so it was 80 grand, you guys, raised to help Puerto Rico.
Girl, when our president didn't do shit.
Barely even acknowledged them.
He went out there and threw some paper towels at people.
Rude. How awful.
Right.
How just absolutely awful.
Yeah.
So, anyway, that the original point that we were making is that, you know, reality TV can really portray people and do things that, like, don't even exist. And in the case of...
I would still do it.
Of course. Like,
I would still do it.
I would definitely still do it. And then I would get real fucking familiar with the block button on all my social media. Like...
You would probably just not be on social media anymore.
I'm
pretty sure you would get some pretty nasty
emails. Oh my God, I'm sure. Like, the problem with this is, you guys, ironically, Pearl and I were talking off the air about this situation that happened to me over the weekend, where somebody really misrepresented the facts of a situation I was in that involved me over the weekend. Like, completely misconstrued what happened. And I spent 2 days fucking reading about it and, like, hearing about it from people and being in a total tailspin, because I'm actually quite a sensitive person. So if, like, the whole internet was attacking me, I would be, like, fucking just beyond butthurt. I would be so devastated.
I would live.
Girl, that's just rude. Live. That is rude because, like, I mean, I can completely understand why there have been numerous people who have gotten really negative things said about them after Drag Race who almost either want to give up drag or threatened to give up drag or felt like giving it up because, like, you're doing it because you're having fun and then all these people are attacking you and you're like, well, this is just no fucking fun. Like, is it the idea of going to a club to do what you generally love to do, knowing that a third of the people in the audience, like, hate you and have never, like, actually had any interaction with you at all?
Yeah.
That would be exhausting to me. Like, the idea of it would be exhausting. The thought that...
But that's what comes with celebrity, girl.
Right. Well, I mean, Fifi O'Hara was on Drag Race 6 years ago. And
the first time, yeah.
The first time. And has spent that entire time trying to live down what the way she was presented there. Mm-hmm. And there are people...
She's not the only one, though.
No.
I mean, Roxy Andrews said it.
Oh, Roxy Andrews as well. Like, the interesting thing to me about the show, and for anyone who's worked closely with the girls... By the way, is it this weekend that we're working with Gia Gunn?
This weekend we're working with Gia Gunn.
Pearl and I are working with Gia Gunn and Aju at Bow on Sunday night, so come out and catch us. But anybody who has met these girls, generally speaking, yes, a few of them that seem like a bitch on TV really are... But I think the ironic part, the irony of the situation, is that some of the girls who seem super nice on the show maybe are super nice when they start out, and then whether it's fame that goes to their head or whether they're playing a really good game on the show turn out to be, like, just dreadful. And, I mean, we're looking at, like, look at last season. People just eat Valentina up still.
Yeah.
And I think it's... I'm confused by that because I think the kind of person she is just abundantly clear.
Terrible, girl.
I think it's abundantly clear. And why people don't want to see that, I don't understand. It's not my place to say, or it's really not my place to understand. But, girl, it's a mess.
It is a mess.
So.
But that's, you know, celebrity.
It is, and it is. And that comes with celebrity. And as I've heard numerous girls say, like, people always say, well, that's what you signed up for. That's what you signed up for. And
well, I'll sign that, bitch, if I can get that celebrity money, bitch.
That really is what you have to ask yourself. Is it worth cringing every time I go on Twitter to...
Bitch, I'll hire someone to go on Twitter for me so I don't have to deal with it.
Yeah.
I don't like being on social media like that anyway.
I love interacting with other people via social media. I love interacting and getting to know people. I like
doing that in real life.
I like doing it in real life too, but I actually, the funny thing is, like, what I was telling Pearl about, this relates to something Pearl and I were talking about in the car ride over here, because Pearl's on her Instagram scrolling through, like, the people that she follows, newsfeed. Mm-hmm. I'm on Instagram going through the news feeds of people who follow me because I was like, people had like commented or liked or sent messages. And so I was like looking at what they were doing because I want to know who's interested in me. I want to see who's like following me or whatever. And part of that is because of the fact that I do feel like staying in touch with my real friends or people that I really know.
Oh, look at her using real friends, you guys.
Well, I mean that in a different way, you guys, than Pearl does. What I mean by that is that people I actually have interaction with. When I say, like, real friends, I mean, like, real people in my real life.
That's what I mean also.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
Because when I was going through these news feeds, the pictures and postings of people on Instagram, these were people I, like, maybe have met one time or, like, have never met before. I just want to see who's interested in what I'm doing.
Uh-huh.
When my people in my real life are like, you probably already saw this on my Facebook. I'm like, no, bitch, didn't see it on your Facebook. I don't really do that. I don't really scroll through Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
But I do like interacting with people on social media or seeing what people are saying or following. So it would be very frustrating to me. But I suppose, girl, if I was getting, like, $5,000 to put on a wig and a dress and go spend fucking a half hour twirling around in a club, I sure would be doing it.
Right.
So if you, like, I'd be like, well, that's nice that you don't like me. Like, this money is, like, pretty comforting. Like, I'll get some comfort over here.
Right.
Plus, like, hopefully if you go on to one of those shows and things don't pan out for you in terms of, like, public response, because people close to you still know what the fuck time it is. And
yeah.
That,
You have to know who your real friends are.
You have to know who really knows you and who are really invested in you. Which is why, for example, this thing that I was talking about over the weekend, like when this person publicly posted some bullshit that was like really kind of absurd. All the people who were close to me were like, really, bitch? The way this was made to sound like, as somebody who knows you, I know that you would never do that. I know you would never do that. And right. So that was like kind of comforting, but still, like, the idea that who knows who is going to think who knows what is, like, a little taxing, a little trying, but...
Girl, it comes with a gig.
It does come with a gig. It comes with the life, girl. The life of being... whatever. In the public. Living in the public. You know, right. Drag performers live in the public to some right. degree. The public owns part of our lives.
Right.
You know...
Yeah, they're the ones paying us.
Yeah, exactly. So they own part of your life, so they're making a payment towards it. So, still, all right, I'm not sure where this started or where it's going to end. So, we're going to take a quick break with that in mind, and we'll be right back after this.
GuideToGay.com is a proud media sponsor of Party Foul Radio with Poyo and Pearl. GuideToGay.com is Australia's premier LGBTQ news information celebrity and travel website destination. Visit GuideToGay.com to stay abreast of everything that's happening down under. And remember, Guide to Gay is a media sponsor of Party Foul Radio.
Hey, what's up, y'all? This is Kelly Clarkson. I'm hanging out with Party Foul Radio.
Hi, this is Poyo Del Mar. And to read the print coverage of our recent Party Foul Radio interview with superstar Kelly Clarkson, giving us all the ins and outs of her brand new album, Meaning of Life, pick up your copy of San Francisco's Left Magazine today. Left Magazine is San Francisco and the Bay Area's most gorgeous queer publication, covering all of the events taking place in the nightlife scene here in Northern California. And guess what? Kelly Clarkson is on the cover of the November issue. Pick up your copy of Left Magazine in San Francisco's Castro District or visit them online at liveleft.com. That's San Francisco's Left Magazine online at liveleft.com.
Hi, it's Matt Matthews, and you're listening to Party Foul Radio.
And welcome back to Party Foul Radio. I am Poyo Del Mar. I'm excited to bring to you our first and only interview of this episode. For over 20 years, singer Trey Pearson struggled with his sexuality, specifically as he was fronting the Christian rock band Everyday Sunday. During the course of Everyday Sunday's career, the group scored a total of 7 top 10 singles on Christian radio, 4 of which went on to become number 1 singles. It was just last summer that the Columbus, Ohio-based singer finally decided to come clean with both himself and the listening public about his sexuality, coming out as a gay man. Since that time, he has embraced his sexuality and become an outspoken advocate for the LGBTQ community, and now is finally releasing his first work as an out gay man. The EP, The Good Grief, is available beginning this Friday, the 17th of November, with the first single, Love is Love, already available on YouTube. Please welcome to Party Foul Radio, singer Trey Pearson. Thank you so much for talking with me this morning. I appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
And I had the opportunity to listen to the entire EP last night. And
good.
Yeah, and I was very moved, especially knowing what I know about your personal journey to being a Christian artist to being an out pop artist. It certainly makes a lot of the songs on the album seem so much more personal in a way that the public can understand. I was wondering what it was like to pour a lot of your personal experiences out into song like that.
Yeah. It's been a journey. Like, this whole last year and a half has been, overwhelming in so many ways. And I feel like I feel like to have it, this part of you that you suppress your entire life to finally like have that valve that's been like pushed down your entire life, to finally have that burst open has been emotionally overwhelming and freeing and amazing, but also like a lot of grieving. And you know, I have a friend who he has a phrase he calls the good grief, and sort of my mantra through getting through this whole journey, this process of coming out to myself and my family and publicly, because the way he puts it is anytime you're changing seasons of life, there's always something in the season behind that needs to be grieved, even when it's the best thing for you. And that is what I felt big time when I was kind of going through all this. And I think that poured into my songwriting and my creativity, because I think that there's valve that I've been pushing down. And to have that burst open emotionally for me, to experience all these emotions that I've never allowed myself to experience, I think that valve really was something that I had been pushing down creatively as well, because I couldn't allow myself to go there. So the time, I feel like that sort of opened me up in so many ways creatively, and in the way and where I was willing to go, even in my music. And I just think that I think it was therapeutic. I think in a way I felt like I didn't have any other choice than to go deeper down than I ever had before in expressing all these things I needed to express. And I don't know, I think that really came out in these songs that I've been writing.
Now, before I ask you more, you sound a little garbled, almost like you're underwater.
Oh no.
So yeah, it's got kind of a bubbly sound to it. I don't know how to explain it, but yeah, I can definitely understand how it would feel that you are exploring a whole new area of yourself. And definitely, I think that anyone who has come out, regardless of their personal life experiences, would feel that grieving process, because there is a part of your identity and your life that you leave behind. Now, in your instance, it seems particularly profound, because a lot of the people who did support your career previous would appear to have changed their perspective on who you are or felt in some way betrayed by you. And I was wondering what that experience was like, feeling that people who once supported you openly do not now.
Yeah, you know, I think it's, I understand it. I understand why they are where they are, because I grew up with that. I thought that way. I tried to make sense of my world with that sort of worldview. And I think I just kept pushing to try to make sense of it until I just knew that it couldn't work for me anymore. And so I think, you know, it's, you know, having to go through certain experiences sometimes to really force you to be willing to change your ideas about things that you're basically grown up with. And when you're sort of brainwashed growing up to believe you can choose to be something that you're not, I don't know, there's a lot to unlearn and there's a lot of damage. And I think I feel bad for people that live in that state, because I think, you know, they don't understand how many lives that kind of belief is actually destroying. And I see the damage that it did to my own life. And so I think, you know, when I think about the good grief and changing seasons in life, you know, I think it's twofold. You know, I think there's this part of you that grieves that, part of me that grieves that I didn't get to experience a lot of things that a lot of most people get to experience growing up, like allowing myself to experience those crushes and those, like, you know, the real young love romance, right? And I think there's a part of me that grieves that. There's a part of me that also accepts that and realizes that I wouldn't be where I am now if I didn't have those experiences. And then there's a part of me that that grieves, like it's not as much the fans that I'm losing that is as hard as, like, the people in my life that I really love with all my heart that just don't love me for who I am. You know, they might try to love me in spite of who I am, but that doesn't work real well. and you end up noticing that you don't really have great relationships with those people anymore because they don't know how to act with you, or they don't know how to just love you genuinely for who you are. And when you can't do that with somebody, you can't have a close relationship with them. And I think that's been more the grieving, even though, you know, I am so thankful to be where I am. I've never felt so free, and I've never been so happy in my life. There's definitely been a loss. And I think it's just accepting that and realizing that sometimes people won't be willing to go there with you, and to be your best self, to be your truest self and your most authentic self, sometimes it means people not loving you for who you are and or accepting it, and when you don't fit within their sort of box of how they think life was supposed to be. And it's crazy to think about all the sociological things that go into that, you know, like how we end up where we do. But yeah, so I think even though there is a lot to grieve, it's good. And I know that this changing the seasons in my life is, you know, been the best thing that's ever happened to me. But it hasn't been without loss, for sure.
Now, at the risk of asking questions that I am certain at this point you feel you've already answered, without forcing them to go do a lot of research, I do want to ask you a few questions that I know that you've answered. And one of those, one of those would be that as a person who has for such a long period of time to repress your authentic self and, you know, through your career as a Christian artist, I was wondering what became the tipping point for you where you realized that you had to come out and acknowledge who you really are and embrace that.
Yeah, I mean, it was the failure in my marriage. It was the constant failure in my marriage and not being able to be who my wife needed me to be. You know, I never made out with a girl before I got married. I had never done anything with a girl, and I had put all my hope, faith, and trust in the bleeding when I was taught growing up. You know, like, we grew up in sort of evangelical Western Christian culture in our day. The idea is you're supposed to wait till you get married to have sex, and that was easy. I didn't have this desire to, but I wanted to have this desire to, you know? I wanted to fall in love. I'm a romantic. I wanted to know what that was like, what that feeling was like. And when you are confused on what those feelings are supposed to be like, you know, like, I think going back in my life and processing, gosh, my friendships, my relationships, everything that led up to that, the feelings that I was looking for, trying to experience that romantic experience with a girl because that's what I was taught that was how it worked, you know? And so, but, you know, going into my wedding night, my honeymoon, you know, fingers crossed, praying, begging God to just let everything go right. And it didn't. And I figured that out very quickly how difficult that journey was going to be. But I just kept hoping it would get better. I kept thinking maybe I'm doing something wrong. Maybe this could be better. Maybe that could be better. And then I could be more physically attracted to her, to a girl, you know, and I felt a lot of guilt, a lot of shame, but, you know, I committed my life to her, I loved her, I still do, you know, and I just wanted to be everything she needed me to be, and I wanted to experience what that would feel like, and it just never came. And then all of a sudden I found myself years into my marriage going, oh my gosh, all these things that I kept hoping would get better the first week of my marriage still aren't better. And we just sort of came to this place where she finally, like, you know, through some certain circumstances, finally, for the first time seriously, was able to ask me if I was gay. And I hadn't even been able to admit to myself at this point, let alone anybody else. And so, you know, when you've failed miserably in bed and trying to be what she wants you to be, all of a sudden I felt like I was just at this point where I could either choose to keep suppressing it and make things worse, or I could choose to get help. And so in that moment, I chose to get help and reached out. You know, at this point in my life, I'd definitely been progressing in my faith, and I definitely didn't see my faith, you know. I think it was always evolving, but I had come to a point where several years before that, shortly after I got married, I think me and my wife came to a place where we were much softer in our position towards same-sex love, you know, like I was able to become affirming for other people, but at that point it didn't even feel like an option for myself, and so I just kept suppressing it, kept trying not to be gay, and trying to convince myself that I wasn't, and so, yeah, it was very difficult, but I felt like in that moment where she asked me if I was gay, I felt like I could either keep suppressing it, or maybe that was my chance to be set free. And so I decided to get help in that moment. And through several months of just counseling and things like that, I finally was able to accept myself for the first time and come out to myself and then to her and my family. And yeah, it was a really, really difficult journey that, you know, months went by where, you know, I think over that few-month period, there weren't a handful of days that I didn't completely bawl my eyes out, realizing that my life was never going to look the same, and there was a scared feeling of not knowing what's on the other side, and also this, like, hope that maybe I'm going to be set free, and this is sort of, like, beginning to process my entire life up to that point that got me to where I was, and that's a lot to deal with emotionally, but, yeah.
Listening to your story, I 100%, I can relate on many levels. First and foremost, we are both from Ohio, which is, shout out to the Buckeye State. And,
yes.
And, you know, I remember in my own journey, I had come out to close friends and was coming out to myself at the age of like 21, 22. And there was a moment where I found myself, I couldn't tell my family, because that's something that when, for those of us who have gone through the process, we know that that is one of the most frightening elements, because we fear that the people who we love the most will reject us, right? I mean, that's certainly what plays into our mind. And there was a tipping point for me was when my sister asked me just outright, and you know, it's that split second moment for me, at least, where I said, am I going to tell the truth or am I going to continue this lie? You know, and,
yeah.
And of course, you know, in my instance, it was in public. It was kind of tragic, but we were at a Little Caesar's Pizza in a Kmart, which is so embarrassing, but it happened. And, and it was a big scene, you know, but I felt free in that moment, yeah. Even though the consequences were out of my hand at that point. It's like, you know what?
Yeah, you know,
I did it.
Yeah. And I think, like, you know, by the time I decided, made it up in my mind that, like, the more I said it, the first time I ever said it out loud was to this pastor friend of mine after I just sort of, like, decided to get help and to face this. And I just, after I said it out loud to him, that was the first time I ever had been able to say it out loud to somebody. I just cried and cried and cried, and I think the more I kept saying it, the more hope and strength I found in it. And, you know, obviously I think that huge fear of
not knowing how my wife was going to react when I would tell her, even though I think she probably knew it was coming at this point. When I said it out loud to her, she, in that moment, she was so gracious and so beautiful about it. She just broke down crying and hugged me and told me that she loved me and how proud of me she was for being able to be honest with myself. And in that moment, the amount, I mean, I had never felt that such a feeling of a weight being lifted off of myself. Like, I never felt so free as what I was able to feel in that moment. And it's unbelievable. And from then on, you know, I felt like once she was able to do that for me, I knew I was going to be okay. And I, you know, there's still a lot of fears of not knowing how people will react, but yeah, I mean, it's crazy. I think there's still so many people don't realize how huge of a deal it still is for so many people today. And
absolutely.
I'm so grateful. Yeah, I'm so grateful for the people that have come before us that allowed me to finally get to a place where I could accept myself, because I realize that there's so many people's stories that have slowly made an impact in my life where I was finally able to accept other people and then finally able to accept myself. And I realized just from the thousands and thousands of messages I've gotten since I came out last summer, how much further we still have to go and why it's so important to tell our stories and why there's such a responsibility there.
Yeah, I the other thing that struck me when I was listening to your story or your response was that, you know, one of my great regrets, if there is one, I try not to live in regret, but if there's something that I regret, it's how my decision to keep secrets impacted other people. And a huge part of that is that, like you, when I was in college in Cleveland, I had a girlfriend that I was with for most of my time, and it was the same experience that you described. I thought that if I built up this exterior that reflected what I felt was appropriate or proper for me, that at some point that thing inside me would shift and it would be what I wanted, what I, you know, I would begin to respond to it. I had this, you know, this beautiful woman, so kind, so everything, you know, and I really did love her, but I didn't love her in the way she needed me to. And I realized
absolutely
2 years into that relationship that I never could. And
yeah,
the fact that it hurt her, you know, we weren't at that place that you and your wife had come to where we had been together a significant amount of time where the romance element of it takes secondary to the friendship element. You know what I mean? And I know that it hurt her. And that was such a painful piece of knowledge and experience for me. And so I can understand why you would, that would be such a huge fear for you as well.
Sure.
Now, this experience that you describe has now come out. You said you burst this emotional bubble, of course, and a huge part of it is played out in your music for this record. I was particularly touched. I mean, we get the first piece of it being Love is Love, which is this great piece of poppy music that in lyrically itself probably would seem affirming, but the video itself shows how personal the message is for you. But one of the tracks that really stood out to me was Dear Jesus, and that is so poignant. And
hey, I
wanted you to, Hey Jesus, sorry about that. Yes, Hey Jesus. And I wanted you to talk about your experience writing, recording, and putting that out eventually for the world to hear.
Yeah. I was one of those songs, you know, like some of these songs take longer than others to write. But that one just came to me while I was sitting in my living room with my guitar as I was kind of working on this album. And I'd actually already started recording the album, and I was just sitting at home and just sort of thinking about my journey, just kind of playing guitar. And that song, the whole thing came to me in less than a half hour. I just, But then I spent another couple hours laying. Literally, I'm standing right where I was writing a song, but I fell out of my seat in tears, and I just went to my knees and laid on the floor, bawling my eyes out. Because I think those are all the emotions that I had felt. And those were all the things that I had been begging God not to let me be. And the song isn't even necessarily about being theologically correct. It was just pouring out those feelings of everything that I had felt for my entire life. And I realize that there are millions and millions of other people that have felt the same exact way. Yeah, so I think there's a few songs on here. I feel like each song is definitely about some part of my journey over this last year and a half. Some of the songs, you know, I think every song on here I wanted either to make you dance or to cry. Some of them both, but I think this one, even when I took it into the studio, I just said I have to add this one to the album. And you know, my engineer Tom, he listened to it and he said, yeah, so we went straight in and laid it down, and I mean, we were both an emotional mess through the whole process, I think, from me sitting in a room by myself writing it to going into the studio and recording it to listening to the mixes as they came back. I think it's something that's continually brought me to tears, and I don't know. I think it's just one of those huge questions that so many queer people face. I think in the U.S., it's like 50% of LGBTQ people still call themselves Christians today. And you think about how many have grown up in religious environments that have rejected it because they had felt so rejected growing up, or whatever reasons that aren't. You know, I just think how much of the LGBTQ community has been impacted by Christianity and Jesus and religion, and I don't know. I feel like it's a huge part of my story, and I just felt like I didn't want to hold anything back when it came to writing, one, for myself, because it was so therapeutic, but two, just that I felt like I needed to go there to just sort of I guess face my own shit to some degree. I think it's, I don't know, I think it's one of those songs that is just something that I had to put out there, and that's even the thing with this kind of EP, mini album, whatever, this thing is, it's 7 songs. I wanted it to, you know, it's not a full-length album, it's not like there's some major label putting this out. I left my Christian label a while ago, and I wanted it to be short enough that, you know, in a singles world people could consume, but I really needed it to be long enough to express a lot of the emotions that I've gone through over this last, you know, year. And I don't know, I just knew as soon as I wrote this song that it had to be a part of what this kind of first collection of songs that I put out there was, because it's so deeply ingrained into what my story is.
Yeah, it feels like it's addressing the elephant in the room.
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
The other thing that struck me about this particular song was that given your individual story, you know, and the lyrical contents definitely address your personal story, but the idea behind it that stood out with me is even more universal, because one thing that has always confounded me in religions of all sorts that condemn queer people or gayness or homosexuality of any nature is that if for those who believe the heart of Christianity's teachings, first and foremost, it's that all humans by our very nature are sinners, and that we are all forgiven if we choose to embrace faith. And so the idea that any one individual who is Christian, who identifies as Christian, would be looking at and examining their own life and questioning or not whether Jesus loves them, regardless of their imperfections, that's a universal message. It goes beyond homosexuality.
Sure. Yeah. I get that, but I think there's a fundamental question going on underlying all of it that is asking, am I loved for who I am, or am I loved in spite of who I am? You know, am I bad because I'm gay or queer or, you know, trans or whatever? Is there something wrong with me, or am I loved and embraced and accepted for who I was created to be? You know, now, your sexuality is such a deep part of who you are, and when you are constantly and brainwashed that there's something wrong with you from a young age, you might think that, oh, well, God will forgive me or God will still love me. But I don't think anybody who believes in this kind of loving God wants to stay there, you know? And I think that's so important to tell people that you are not a sinner because you were created queer, you know? And I think, yes, I get the idea that, you know, everyone makes mistakes or you know, in a kind of religious setting, you know, believes everybody sins or whatever. But I think there's a huge difference between thinking, oh, I'm doing something wrong by lying to this person or hurting this person or whatever, and being gay. And when you associate those two things as somehow connected, somehow it's like just as bad for me to kill you or rob you as it is because you happen to be gay. I think that's when a lot of like psychological dysfunction sort of comes in, you know, and it's very confusing. And I just think, wow, you know, like as much as we understand about sexuality and things today, it really does take growing up in that kind of environment to really think that there's something wrong with you for that. And I think it's so important to teach young Christians that it is not a sin to be gay, and it's not the same thing, and you are loved for who you are. You are not loved in spite of who you are loved and accepted for who you are, and that's beautiful. I don't know. I think I have trouble accepting that, everybody sins. My sin is just that I'm gay. It's like, well, no, you know, like, there's nothing wrong with me for being gay. I'm loved and accepted just as I am. And that was a huge thing that took me a really long time to learn and to accept for myself.
Well, I would like to a point of clarification from my perspective, because I certainly do not think that being gay, trans, bisexual, lesbian, any of the people under our family of flags, you know what I mean?
Sure.
I do not think that is a sin. I do not think we are bad. I don't think we are to be judged for that. I firmly believe that we are created as who we are. And if you believe that, if you are of the belief, meaning you, the general populace, if somebody out there believes that that God creates all things as they are meant to be, and that there is no mistakes in his world or that world, then we are exactly as we're intended to be. I certainly believe
Absolutely.
That I was created this way. What I'm saying is that for people, I've always found it disconcerting that people of particular faiths and of particular practices place a hierarchy on sin and thusly attack more one group more than others. That's what I'm saying. And so
it's like parents that will go to their kid's wedding, even if they're, you know,
child is divorced, they'll still show up to the wedding, even if they believe it's a sin to get remarried, but they won't show up to their gay kid's wedding because somehow that's like a big sin that must be worse because they're gay, if you believe that. I get what you're saying.
Yeah, I definitely, and I, it was important for me to clarify that because I don't want to in any way impress upon people that I have any level of shame or that I think there's any level of shame in being who we are. And what you say is so true. The idea that we are, you know, forgiven in spite of or loved by whatever our higher power or, you know, God of our understanding is in spite of. Like, I don't buy into that. I think we're created the way we are. I believe we are exactly who we are. And how we choose to live ourselves, if, you know, I think that there's a code of ethics and morals that probably go along with each of those that may be up for discussion, but I definitely do not think at our core we, any of us are wrong. So,
yeah,
one of the song on this EP that I listened to probably 15 times in a row and felt more wrenched each time I listened was the final track, which is The Good Grief Part 2. And
yeah,
it felt, for me, I'm not sure exactly why. I think it's probably where I'm at emotionally at the moment. But it felt so wrenching, this idea that, you know, I don't know if it was about a specific relationship for you or perhaps your relationship, you know, with your faith or with your whatever. You know, the idea to me seems so just very, very touching. The very first line, you got me at the first line, about listening to the voicemails. I was like, oh, I've been there.
Yeah.
So tell me more about that track.
Oh, gosh. That's another one that I wrote out on my guitar in my living room. And I'd say that was another one that came to me pretty quickly. I might have got the original idea for the beginning of the song in my head and left myself a voice note on my phone, and then I came home and then I wrote the rest of it out and I laid on the floor and bawled my eyes out. It's deeply personal to me, and I think it very much has to do with that loss that we experience, and I don't think I want to say too much about the deep myth, you know, about, you know, what it's about, but I think, like what we were saying before, is just that even though I'm so thankful to be set free and to be where I am in my life, it still come with loss, and those are things that need to be grieved, and things that were painful, and just sort of, I guess, I needed to accept that and allow myself to grieve that, and I think allowing myself to grieve it, for being able to forgive myself and still love, no matter if I receive that love in return or not, I think is super important. And it's just kind of what I had felt from experiencing some of the loss that I did and going through all this.
Trey, as an interviewer and as the listeners, I think the impression that you're going to give here is that you spend a lot of time crying, and
yeah.
And I was wondering if that emotional connection you have with yourself, because even though I say that in a joking fashion, I don't place judgment on that because I think that individuals who are able to tap into their emotions, embrace those, kind of lean into some of that experience, I think that's a beautiful thing. I also think it's a very sexy thing. I think that a person who's in touch with their emotions is far sexier than a person who's closed off from them. I was wondering, though, is that
where you are currently emotionally, or is that where you are as a person? Is that who you are?
I'm a very emotional person. I think I've always been a very emotional person, but I think this is a part of myself that I had closed off for so long and never allowed myself to go there emotionally. To all of a sudden, like, experience all these new things. there's been a lot, to be emotional about.
Amen.
So, like, I even my first kiss with a guy, like, I mean, I was, like, trying not to cry because all of a sudden my mind was just like, oh, I mean, there's, like, all this excitement there, too, but, like, all this, like, oh, my gosh, like, I have never allowed myself to experience this. And all of a sudden, all these feelings are just rushing, you know? And so, I mean, in general, I'm just, you know, I'm a very happy person. I'm a very positive person. But I do believe in allowing myself to grieve. And, you know, I'm thankful there's this author, Rob Bell. He's the one that, he has a podcast called The Robcast. And one of his first episodes was called The Good Grief. And he's been a mentor of mine for, gosh, eight years now. So shortly into my marriage, I met him, and he's already my favorite author. And he's a beautiful person to have in my life going through all this. But I think it was just that encouragement to not try to pretend that there aren't things that need to be grieved, even though you're happy and even though you are excited to be where you're at. To allow all those things to be there together, to take the joy and the excitement. And I think there's definitely songs about that on this EP. I think you listen to the first couple songs, Love is Love and Rush, and those songs are starting to turn the corner in this excitement, this hope. And Rush is very much about these silly crushes, and one in particular, and allowing myself to experience that and the excitement of that. But also to be able to hold in the other hand, this open hand of, you know what, there's this part of you that you suppress your entire life. You deserve to be able to grieve that, to allow yourself to feel the hurt of that sometimes, and to be okay with that. And that is very important to me. And it was very important for all of those emotions to come out on this record.
Absolutely. I think that a lot of people feel guilt in grieving. They feel that a societal pressure to always be happy, to always present a certain face to the world. And that is so unhealthy, because we are given a full range of emotions for a reason. And the only time any one of those emotions really, in my perspective or in my experience, has become problematic is if I hold on to it past its due date, when it's expired and I'm still holding on to it.
Sure.
You know, and
absolutely.
And I certainly am glad that you mentioned Rush. It's such a sweet and fun up-tempo pop track, and it definitely addresses the idea and feelings that we all experience when we're feeling that connection, you know, for the first time with somebody.
You
mentioned your first kiss with a man, and I was wondering how a person in your situation, you know, with a level of fame and celebrity, certainly with a focus on the in the public eye, found your way to that experience. Where did you meet? How did that develop? How did it get to that point?
I guess I'll start with, you know, sort of several months after I had kind of gone through this with myself and my family, I decided that I had this, like crazy huge desire to go to this, like, gay bar in, like, the kind of most popular neighborhood of Columbus.
Lots of gay bars in Columbus.
It's called Union, and it's, like, it's the most popular bar in the entire city of Columbus, which, you know, Columbus is pretty big city. It's, like, the 15th biggest city in the country, a couple million people, and so this bar is, like, where, you know, everybody goes to hang out, and I wanted to experience what that was like to hang out at a gay bar. And there was also, like, you know, having this kind of fear of not knowing how people are going to react. There was this desire to find a safe place where I felt like
nobody was going to look at me weird or judge me, or, you know what I mean? And I'm sure so many people can relate to that.
Of course.
That desire for that feeling. And I think that's why we talk about gay bars as such a safe space and a sacred space, because it really felt that way when I went in there for the first time. I walked in, and I was nervous as all get out. I was nervous as hell, but I wanted to be there and be with a place that I felt like was my people, my community. And so I went in. I didn't know anybody. I wasn't meeting up with anybody. I just wanted to know what it was like. And I walk in, and I just want to be a fly on the wall. I just want to experience what it's like. So I was like, now I'll go back to the bathroom. And then I'll sit in the bar and get a drink. And this is, you know, it's like all these like weird, nervous butterfly feelings. And so I went in and I'm walking back to the bathroom. And this guy sticks his head out of the like DJ kind of booth where they, you know, play the music videos from on the screens. And he's like, "Trey?" And I was like, "Oh my God." and this guy, he used to be the morning show host for the huge Christian radio station in Columbus, and he got fired when they found out he was gay, like, 7 years ago. And he's like, "Trey?" I was like, "David." He's like, "What are you doing?" He's like, "Stopped mid-sentence." He's like, "I knew it." I was like, "Oh, my gosh." And, you know, referencing that he knew that I was gay or had this tough feeling, I guess. I don't know. But I quickly felt comfortable there, and he just gave me this huge hug. And I ended up seeing another person that I had known when I was younger. And I just slowly kind of had, like, I met a lot of the staff that worked there, but and that's sort of who I got to know at first. So I slowly just kind of had to put myself out there to just sort of get to know people. And I slowly, over several months, built some friendships. But, I mean, one thing I want to say is just, like, even though I didn't move cities when I came out, it had felt like I'd moved to an entirely different city, because, like, all the people that were in my life weren't in my life anymore, except my older sister. I just feel like I had to completely start over as far as friends, because it's like there's people that say they love you, but they don't really want to have any sort of relationship with you. That was
too true.
A very difficult thing. And so I was very much starting over, building this new life. And I mean, it's crazy to think about where I am now, like a year and a half later. That's pretty awesome, pretty unbelievable. But I slowly built relationships and friendships, and I don't know, one night I ended up getting to kiss this guy, and it was absolutely amazing. And just like each of these like first experiences, like the first time at a gay bar, first passionate, romantic kiss with another guy. All these firsts that I have experienced over this last year is, my story came out at the beginning of the summer last year, and two and a half weeks later, I headlined Pride Festival, so I had my first Pride Parade, which I again, bawled, because it's like just seeing like all these people, the strength of all these people coming together in unity. It was unbelievable, and I've heard that from so many people. Like, they don't realize how emotional their first Pride Parade is going to be. And so there's been all these firsts over this last year, and it's come with a ton of emotions, like excitement, joy, freedom, beauty, but also like this grief that I can't believe I never got to experience this before. I can't believe that so-and-so isn't here to experience this with me. Those kinds of things, you know. Yeah, it's very crazy, but very good, but also very emotional, and yeah.
Well, I think that that's fantastic, and I think that that is very natural. As a person who's been out for a long time, it's very good to hear about that joy and excitement, because trust me on this one, not to be a Debbie Downer, but honey, it goes away. You're like, huh. This again, oh dear.
It hasn't for me yet. I love it. So. Well,
no, of course, and it won't for a long time. There will be many more firsts for you, and that is the exciting part of it. And you know, that is the exciting part, and it is a whole new world. It's a whole new life, and a big part of it is just getting to getting to be authentic. You know what I mean? Like, that's really, that's a really huge part of it. One of the things I think pretty much possibly in closing, I kind of wanted to ask you what it is like as a musician, because I think you had mentioned early in our discussion that you felt like you couldn't really be authentic in your lyrics. You couldn't be authentic in your writing because there was so much of yourself that you were hiding and denying. And what is the experience as a writer and a musician when you get to really just not have to hold back anything that who you are, what you think, what you feel?
Yeah. I don't think that, like, I had felt in my mind like I wasn't able to be authentic. I just felt like I was being the best I understood how to be. And
totally valid.
I honestly, looking back, now processing that, I just did not know how to go there. I wasn't able to go there emotionally, even though I would have understood it that way at the time. But to be where I am now, yeah, you know, it's like, just like in the rest of my life, there's this part of me that was pushed down so far to have that kind of burst open. I feel like that has done so creatively for me as well. And yeah, it's given that liberation of being able to be your most authentic self, feeling like you don't have anything you need to hide anymore. That has deeply gone into allowing myself to really go to those deep places authentically in my music and in my songwriting. And I really feel like, I mean, even just like from, I say that about the sad, you know, like maybe the sadder songs like The Good Greens and Hey Jesus, but I also mean that even with sort of the excitement of like Rush or Don't Dance, or even Where Don't Dance Goes, you know, that very much has to do with people that don't want to accept me and love me for who I am. And, you know, it's like, to be able to go there lyrically where I was able to go with those songs, I never could have done that before when it comes to these deep things that really are another level. And I think, you know, I think there are songs that I've written before that I'm very proud of that are very honest and very beautiful, but I just think that there's another level of deepness that I've been able to go to in writing the CP. And yeah, I'm really, really proud of it. I feel really connected to it, and I hope other people connect with it because of how much it, you know, is a part of my story and how much it means to me, I guess.
Yeah, I 100% have always believed that there are times when either through deep denial in ourselves or just what we believe, I've always felt that the truth is very relative, because sometimes we believe one thing to be the truth, and then when we get some perspective, we're like, wow, I was really misguided. You know, like, I was really misguided.
Absolutely.
And think of songs, for example, like The Rush, and I believe that you couldn't have written that authentically in the past because you'd never allowed yourself to feel that. You'd never
Absolutely.
Felt it, you know? And it takes on a whole new meaning, especially because it's about that. I mean, I really like that song, by the way. And
Thank you. It's
something that until you allow yourself to feel it, you can't write about it. You know, it's about that. It really is about that first experience of like, whoa, I've got butterflies. Like, this is something.
Yep.
This is something, I don't know what, but it's something.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true, and it feels so exciting to get to be willing to go there, and to go there authentically and kind of deeper down into myself to lay out there for people, and not to kind of, I don't know, send it out into the world and share it. That's an exciting feeling.
I just want to tell you how I feel really right now after this conversation, I feel enriched by our conversation, and I feel that I was really excited when I was asked to speak with you or if I'd be interested, just because I really like Love is Love. I think it's a great song. It's super fun and poppy.
Thank you so much.
And so that's what sold me. And then I did a little research and found out who you are beyond just knowing the video, because I didn't know your story. And then when I read about your story, it made me more excited for our conversation. And now I feel like sometimes, and this is one of the things that I always want to do with my podcast, my radio show, through my writing, is that I want to discover people and appreciate them and then be able to share that with people who will have a greater appreciation for them because I've introduced them. And I really feel that at the end of our conversation, I have an appreciation for you that I could not have had prior to this conversation. So I'm really grateful and thank you.
Wow. Well, thank you so much. That means a lot.
So how can people, I know that you are just, first of all, I don't even know how to pronounce your last name. Is it Pearson or Pearson?
Pearson.
Okay.
Pearson.
Right. I pronounced it Pearson, and my co-host, who is not sitting in on this because she's got like a day job, said, I think it's Pearson. I was like, okay, well, I don't know. So
for the
listeners out there, you can disregard the previous like 50 minutes of our conversation. The mystery has been solved. It's Pearson. So there you go. That's all we needed to know. And it's just Trey Pearson on Twitter. How else should people be able to find you? I know you've got TreyPearson.com.
Yeah. I think just like anything, like Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, it's all just at Trey Pearson or / Trey Pearson. Snapchat, TreyPearson.com. Very easy to find me. So I think the only thing that's different is my YouTube channel is Trey Pearson Official. Otherwise, I think you could just search it or go to my website and find me there.
Now, the first time that you legit fall in love and, like, kind of lose your mind, because trust me, darling, it's going to happen. It happens when you fall in love. Like, it does. It doesn't even have to be a real thing. Like, I've recently fallen in love with somebody who's not even in love with me, and I'm still going crazy. But you...
I get it.
But when that happens, I want you to come back and tell me about it.
Okay, we'll talk more sometime.
Yeah, I want to be able to follow the excitement of what it's like to get to. I want to be on the ride and on the journey and the roller coaster of all your firsts.
Yes, all right, sounds great.
All right, thanks for joining us, and I look forward to talking to you in the future.
Thanks for having me.
All right, bye.
Bye.
Hi, everybody. This is Poyo Del Mar, and you probably think my gorgeous appearance is just built on great makeup and good jeans. Well, that's partially true, but I also visit my good friend Janine over at Laser Away Hair Removal in San Francisco's Castro District, located at 410 Castro Street, and with a second location in downtown San Francisco at Union Square. Laser Away offers Botox injections, Juvederm laser hair removal, photo facials, cool sculpting, lip injections, oh my gosh, liquid facelifts, you name it, they've got it. They even have laser tattoo removal. So if you need a little pick-me-up, or if you want to counteract some of gravity's effects on our face, go check out Laser Away Hair Removal and tell them Poyo Del Mar sent you.
All right, you guys, we are back. That was singer Trey Pearson. His new album titled The Good Grief is available this week.
Good grief.
So check it out. And, of course, his new single, his latest single, Love is Love, is available now on YouTube. Go check it out. I thought the interview was really interesting. I did think that I'm glad he laughed when I was like, honey, do you ever stop crying? Like, it sounds like you're always, in, you know, in our conversation, he'd be like, and then I just, like, broke down right there in my living room while I was writing the song. I was like, girl, you spend a lot of time crying, boo. So, luckily, I mentioned that to his publicist, Ryan at the Carpel Group in New York City, who arranged the interview, and he said, I'm actually talking to Trey right now after, as a follow-up on your interview, and he thought it was really funny that you said that. So I'm like, thank God he's got a sense of humor about it, because...
Are you ever worried that someone won't? I mean, I figured, well...
Well, I mean, Pearl will tell you, like, every time you hear her joining an interview, she's like, here goes Poyo, I was going to offend somebody, whatever.
Right.
And I don't think that it was asked in a way that's offensive, and it was just like, honey, it sounds like you cry a lot, like, or it's just like, but for him, I did understand it, because he is writing, this is the first album that he's written after coming out.
Mm-hmm.
It's his first album that he's writing as an openly gay man after years of feeling not only confused by his own sexuality, but like really had to repress it because he was a Christian rock musician.
Yeah.
So I would imagine that like getting the opportunity to actually put his real thoughts and feel, first of all, even probably even having an understanding of his real thoughts and feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Like, remember when you come to terms with that for the first time, like, oh my God, this is why like everything right. was fucked up because I refused to look at it as what it was. And then to actually get to put that into music and like share that with the world probably is like a lot of crying and a lot of tears, a lot of catharsis and healing for him. So it's a really beautiful album. Fun dance music, fun pop music, some really thought-provoking lyrics on it. Go check it out. Yeah.
And while we're at it, you guys are not going to believe who I met this past weekend.
Oh, fuckery.
And I almost forgot, bitch. You thought I wasn't going to bring it up.
I was definitely not going to bring it up.
I hope he listens to this, too.
I told him
he should.
Oh, my God. I like... Anyway.
So you guys know how Poya was talking about this new date that she's been dating. And
well, I've gone out with him a few times,
and
yes.
He's been showing up to your shows.
He has.
And he's been so sweet. He's so sweet, you guys. So nice. So adorable. I think maybe a little too good for Poyo. But
I sometimes wonder that, too. But, you know, okay, so this is... So Pearl's referencing the fact that the gentleman that I mentioned to you on the last episode... That,
that's what I just said.
Right, that I've gone out with, knew that I was going to be... out of town or working or out of town most of the weekend, so we wouldn't really be able to see each other.
Mm-hmm.
And he unexpectedly showed up at our gig on Saturday at Lookout. So I walk out to start performing, and there he is with one of his coworkers.
That's who that was, yeah.
And so Pearl, of course, got to meet him and everything. So
did he know who I was?
Well, I mentioned you to him before, but okay. That when I went to bring him back to actually mm-hmm. meet you in the back, I said, this is the co-host of my podcast. So this is where, like, I feel really insecure about things. So
this is where?
Well, right. But, like, you know, when it comes to dating, I get really insecure about things because I don't date very often. So it's, like, a little confusing. And
yeah, you're cobwebs, girl.
It's not about cobwebs all over, but it is about cobwebs, emotionally cobwebs, for sure, because... There's not a lot going on.
Girl, by the time Pearl spreads her legs,
okay. So you guys, Pearl has been thinking that I've been teasing about this shit this whole time, and like she's like, oh yeah, right, bitch. But then I was texting her privately, and I was like, girl, I told him like, you know, we've already gone out like 4 times now. You know what that means? Or right. You know, I said, this is our 3rd date, and she's like, oh girl, you better clean out. And I was like, no, girl, like the 3rd date means that he survived the first 2. That's all it means, like.
Girl, that's not what that's supposed to mean.
He saw me in that, remember the red fringe outfit?
Uh-huh.
In drag? And he whispered to me, this is the least amount of clothing I've seen you in.
Oh!
And I said, shockingly, this is also the most amount of clothing you've seen me in because I got so many layers of stuff
tight,
between.
Yeah.
Really, the illusion might be the least amount, but... So, after that, I feel like he's been distant to me.
Oh, really?
I texted him, and, like, his responses seem short. I don't know. Maybe I could be reading too much into it.
Uh-oh.
But I don't know. I don't know.
The dread scared him?
No, I don't think so, because obviously he came twice of his own volition. I don't think it scared him. I don't know. I don't know. Like, that's the thing. Like, I don't know if he's, you know, because he was very, like, let's hang out, and then, like, now I'm not, like, I texted him, like, hey, I'm going to Sacramento now, and he's, like, be safe, and, like, that was his response, and then I texted him today, like, or maybe yesterday, like, I'm back, and he, like, barely responded, and then today I said something like, hey, what are your plans for Thanksgiving, and he was, like, going to North Carolina, that's all he said. It feels really short.
Oh, no.
And so I'm like,
he's a good one. You couldn't keep him, goddammit. I'm so mad at you.
I mean, I don't...
Goddamn.
Well, how about she's mad at me and I've done nothing?
Like, that's probably why.
Well, so, here, like, so, I'm gonna... So, like, So I sent him a text, whatever, like...
Oh, no.
So...
Yep.
So, that, like, you know, enjoy your trip, be safe. He didn't even respond to this text message. Then going to North Carolina, I mean, so I do feel like he's being distant, and I do feel like there is nothing I can do about that. So,
well, yeah, there is. You can see what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose so, but... like, part of me is, like, my instinct is that when things run smoothly, they're running smoothly. And if this early on, like, he's being unresponsive or something, I'm like, okay, well. I mean, I don't know.
I see you guys.
Yeah, I hope that's not the case because he's super nice and he's adorable. But the upside and the downside to not dating very often is the same. The upside is that you spend a lot of time alone and you become comfortable being alone. That's a downside. You become comfortable being alone by being alone. But the upside of that is, like, if something is, like, not going right or whatever, you're like, well, I'm comfortable being by myself. So if it feels...
Well, I mean, I think you should be comfortable being by yourself before you start dating in the first place.
Of course. But I think you understand what I'm saying. Like, it's like... Well, if this situation presents itself and it's all, like, great and hunky-dory and cute, then awesome. But if, like, we start hanging out and something is, like, seems weird or whatever, girl, I, like, 3 weeks ago, I was perfectly comfortable doing myself. Right. So, like, so at any rate, I do hope that, you know, I hope maybe he's just stressed or it's, like, you know, work or whatever. But if it's not, then I will go back to the drawing board.
Right.
And by that, I mean, once again, allowing the spiders to spin their web.
Shit. Well, you guys, that was episode 92. Don't forget to check out our sponsors, which you've heard, and follow us both on Twitter and on Facebook at Party Foul Radio.
Yes, girl, get into it. Party Foul Radio on Facebook and Twitter. Until next time, I'm Poet Almar.
And I'm Pearl P.
We'll talk to you later.
Bye. It's over. It's over. It's over. It's over. She's the one. Girl, you better work.